Hello, I'm John Hilton, editor at the Cochrane Editorial Unit, welcoming you to this monthly roundup from the Cochrane Library. The June 2011 issue of the Cochrane Library includes 27 updated reviews and 35 new reviews, four of which are featured in this roundup. We'll hear from the authors of a new review looking at care at the end of life, and we also feature reviews about two common chronic illnesses that you'll want to avoid along the way, diabetes and heart disease. Also on the Cochrane Library at the moment is a special collection that was launched to mark International Clinical Trials Day in May, showing how partnerships and collaborative networks are helping to ensure that we have relevant, high-quality trials that aim to resolve uncertainties in a variety of settings, including natural disasters. The first of our featured new reviews addresses issues for people who have survived a heart attack or a stroke, and, as a consequence, are at a high risk of having another one. We know that long-term treatment with statins, drugs that lower cholesterol, reduces the risk of heart attacks and stroke. But do these drugs help people who take them straight after a heart attack or stroke? Matthias Briel from McMaster University in Canada describes the finding of his Cochrane review.
Coronary heart disease is a common cause of mortality, accounting for 1 in 5 deaths in the United States. Large trials and meta-analyses have convincingly shown that statins reduce LDL cholesterol and the risk for cardiovascular events and overall mortality in a large spectrum of patients. However, the limitation of most of the trials of secondary prevention after an acute myocardial infarction or unstable angina is that the statins were started 3 or more months after the acute event. Our Cochrane review looks at the effects of starting statins early, since the first few months after the onset of acute coronary syndromes is a critical stage for coronary heart disease with a high risk for recurrent events and death. Several observational studies have suggested a large reduction in mortality in patients with acute coronary syndrome treated with statins before or at hospital discharge. But we know from other areas of healthcare that such studies may be prone to bias due to factors such as survivor treatment selection, competing medical issues, or differences in unknown confounders between the groups that were compared. It was important, therefore, to examine the randomized evidence, and we identified 18 trials that met our inclusion criteria, enrolling a total of over 14,000 patients. The mean age of participants ranged from 53 to 69 years in each trial, and they all recruited mostly men. There was considerable variation in the proportion of participants with a myocardial infarction prior to the index event, and also in the proportion of participants with co-interventions for the index event such as fibrinolytic therapy or percutaneous coronary interventions. When we combined the results of the trials, our meta-analysis found that although the effects were favorable to statins for total death, total myocardial infarction, total stroke, cardiovascular death, revascularization procedures, and acute heart failure at 1 month and at 4 months, none of these effects were statistically significant. Among the main outcomes that we investigated, the one significant reduction was for episodes of unstable angina at 4 months, which was about 25% lower in the statin group. In terms of adverse events, we found that the risk for elevated liver enzymes was significantly higher in the early statin groups than the control groups, but serious events such as myopathy or rhabdomyolysis were rare. Our findings contrast with results from the published observational studies that suggested large mortality reductions within the first month following an acute coronary syndrome. Our meta-analysis of randomized trials shows that observational studies with insufficient control of confounders greatly overestimated the magnitude of effect from early statin therapy in acute coronary syndrome. In considering the effects of statins when used early in acute coronary syndromes, it is important to remember that our meta-analysis considered only endpoint events that occurred during the period of randomized treatment. It is likely that the beneficial effects of statins are cumulative, In most of the landmark trials of statins in chronic coronary heart disease, the benefit was not evident until 1 to 2 years after randomization. Therefore, some of the benefit of statin treatment in the period up to 4 months after acute coronary syndromes may only become apparent after 4 months.
To read this review, look for Statins for Acute Coronary Syndrome at thecochranelibrary.com. Having type 2 diabetes usually means keeping a close watch on your blood glucose levels. And keeping these levels relatively normal, also called glycemic control, is a key part of treatment. A new Cochrane review from a team of researchers in Denmark examines the evidence for different strategies for this approach. You can hear their Danish language podcast at cochrane.org/podcasts. But for this roundup, Ginny Hetherington from the Cochrane Collaboration Secretariat reads an English version.
Type 2 diabetes mellitus is increasingly common worldwide, and the search is continuing for the best way to manage it. This Cochrane review was done to help in that search by focusing on whether intensive glycemic control is superior to conventional glycemic control in reducing mortality and cardiovascular disease in patients with the condition. Cardiovascular disease is important because it's the main cause of premature death for these patients. Patients with type 2 diabetes develop elevated levels of plasma glucose with disturbances in carbohydrate, fat, and protein metabolism. These get worse over time, requiring glucose-lowering treatment to be intensified in order to achieve near-normal glycemia. The first steps for patients with type 2 diabetes are lifestyle interventions, with advice to lose weight and increase physical activity. However, in order to maintain optimal glycemic control, most patients will require additional glucose-lowering therapy. The Cochrane review assesses the effects of targeted intensive glycemic control compared with targeted conventional glycemic control. The Cochrane researchers, based in Denmark, searched for randomized trials comparing these two approaches in adults, looking for published and unpublished trials in any language. They ended up with 20 included trials that had recruited almost 30,000 patients and tested interventions lasting from 3 days to 12 and a half years. The patients in these trials represent a very diverse part of the population with type 2 diabetes. The diagnosis varied between trials, and some trials used a definition which may have led to the inclusion of participants with impaired glucose tolerance rather than type 2 diabetes. Patients were also entered into the trials at different stages of their disease, with some trials recruiting those who had just been diagnosed, while other trials included patients who had been diagnosed sometime in the past. This made the authors of the review cautious in interpreting their findings. When they combined the results of the studies, they found that the treatments did not have significantly different effects on all deaths, or deaths from cardiovascular disease, or several other important outcomes. Among the findings that may favor targeting intensive glycemic control when further data are provided were those for non-fatal myocardial infarctions and amputation of the lower leg. The authors were not able to perform meta-analyses for either health-related quality of life or the costs of the interventions. This review uses a statistical technique called trial sequential analysis to examine whether the significant effect estimates might be due to a lack of sufficient data, indicating that many more patients will need to be randomized to detect differences that would be important to patients and their doctors. In conclusion, it's clear that much uncertainty remains about the effects of treatment on cardiovascular disease and mortality in patients with type 2 diabetes mellitus. Randomized trials are needed to assess the effects in younger patients without complications and in older patients with complications. These trials should also adopt more uniform and rigorous means for reporting the outcomes to make it easier to conduct the meta-analyses that will be required to achieve the sample size needed for reliable comparisons of different glycemic intervention targets.
People at the end of life are often cared for by family and friends. Providing this care can generate strong positive emotions, but it can also be stressful for them, mentally, physically, and economically. Bridget Candy from the Marie Curie Palliative Care Research Unit in London, England, describes a Cochrane review that asked whether support strategies for caregivers, such as advice on caring and practical assistance, are actually beneficial.
Regardless of whether a patient at the end of life phase of a disease is at home or elsewhere, and despite input from health professionals, family and friends are central to their care. However, being in this position can involve considerable physical and psychological and economic stress for the family or friend. The carers experience the suffering of someone who is close to them and might need to adjust to a role without having sufficient information to help them. They may need to provide long hours of care, which might also come with financial strain, as well as having to be involved in end-of-life decision-making. A range of supportive programs are being developed, including educational and psychological support and practical assistance. Randomized trials have been done of supportive interventions for informal caregivers of patients in the terminal phase of a disease, and our Cochrane review brought together this evidence. The review allowed us to examine the effects on the caregiver's physical and psychological well-being, including, for instance, how they coped with the caring role. We had to develop an analytical strategy to manage the diversity of the trials we found in our review, however, as there were many different types of interventions and many different measures for assessing whether the interventions were effective. To overcome this, we grouped the interventions not by content, such as whether they provided educational or emotional support, but how they aimed to facilitate change. We wanted to separate interventions that were directed at the carer from those that might act indirectly via patient care. To overcome the challenges of trials using different outcomes, we combined data into overarching categories. We had a category for psychological distress, for instance, which was measured, for example, as depression or anxiety. Another category was for coping with the caring role, which could have been measured as caregiver burden or stress, for example. We also tried to standardise things by focusing our analysis on data from the first follow-up after the intervention. We found 11 trials with just over 1,800 participants. 9 interventions were directly delivered to the caregiver. 6 of these provided support in the caring role, such as emotional support and advice on providing care. The other 3 involved, in one, testing a family life review, in another, advice on sleep hygiene, and in the third, family grief therapy. None of the trials looked at the provision of practical support. The other 2 interventions aimed to support the carer indirectly via patient care, but we were not able to do much with these because the data were too limited. None of the trials set out to identify adverse effects, but the trial on grief therapy found a significant increase in family conflict in the intervention group amongst a subgroup of families classed by the researcher as hostile when this was measured a year after the intervention. When we combine the results of the 8 trials that compared caregivers who received a directly delivered intervention with those who received no additional support, we found a significant reduction in psychological distress. We also found marginal improvements in coping skills and quality of life, but neither of these analyses was statistically significant. In summary, there is some evidence that supportive interventions may help family and friends cope emotionally, at least in the short term, but this needs confirming in larger rigorous trials. Future research should seek to identify those types of support that might be of more benefit and the types of carers who are more likely to benefit. The uncertainty about the effects on the physical health of caregivers and their use of health services also needs to be tackled, as does the need to evaluate interventions that involve the provision of practical domestic support.
You can read Bridget's review and all of the other reviews discussed in this month's roundup at www.thecochranelibrary.com. Thanks for listening.